Hurricane Isaac makes landfall in Louisiana.
What's the latest from ports and the oil industry? Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Wednesday, August 29th. Coming up, I will speak with the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. He is one of the Fed's hawks who would rather focus on inflation than job creation. That interview is coming up later on the show.
And we've talked a lot about the drought, the effect on crops and on farms. Into that mix, throw a new report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture that says farmer income in the country is going to be at a new record high this year. We'll find out how that works coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Hurricane Isaac is moving inland this morning after making landfall in Louisiana. It is weakening a bit, according to the latest reports, but almost a half a million people are without power. More than 1,000 flights have been canceled.
This morning, we have reports that water is flowing over at least one levee near the Louisiana coast, flooding homes there. Port Fouchon is the industrial heart of the Louisiana coastline, about 60 miles south of New Orleans, and it is shut down. Chet Chasson is the Port Authority's executive director. Good to talk with you.
Hi, good to talk to you.
So what's it been like there overnight?
Oh, it's been really, really rough here. We've had strong winds that have caused some damage. A lot of trees down, a lot of limbs, cable lines. When we had this break with the eye of the storm right now, we wanted to come out and see what was going on and check some of our employees' homes and see if those were okay. Get a little peace of mind helps out in times like this.
Sounds rough, but I gather from what you're telling me, we're probably not dealing with a disaster here.
Well, again, we have a back end of the storm, and we're still in the dark here. But we believe that maybe we have seen the worst, we hope, and may have averted worst-case scenario. But we'll know more tomorrow afternoon.
Chet, tell me about the business, the commerce there in Port Fouchon that you're worried about.
We're the service base for the oil and gas industry in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, we service about 90% of all the deep water activity in the Gulf of Mexico. We service about half of all the drilling rigs in the entire Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, we service 18% of the U.S. entire oil supply.
At this point, how significantly and for how long do you expect your port operations, the oil drilling industry all around you, to be disabled by this thing?
We anticipate, you know, through Wednesday, we will, you know, have to keep things shut down and be able to assess things, make sure it's safe for people to come in, for our businesses to come and assess their facilities and get things moving.
Chet Chasson, Executive Director of the Port Authority in Port Fouchon, Louisiana. Best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
The price of a barrel of oil is headed back down this morning after rising in recent days as the storm approached. Traders seem more confident that Isaac won't cause a long-term disruption in supply.
But the storm has shut down more than 90% of the Gulf of Mexico's oil production, which has sparked the old question of whether it's time to open the nation's strategic petroleum reserve to head off any potential effect on the economy. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
There's a 50-50 chance President Obama will crack open the reserve, according to Fadel Gate, who tracks energy for Oppenheimer & Company.
Nice try, but it might not work.
That's because it's an oil reserve, not a gasoline reserve. More than 40% of oil refineries are in the Gulf. Many are shut down now. If refiners aren't processing oil into gas, prices at the pump are unlikely to go down much. Oh, and it's an election year.
Unfortunately, both sides will take very cheap shots.
Republicans will criticize the move as a political ploy. Democrats will say they're trying to help drivers in a tough economy. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This Friday, central bankers from around the world will gather in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. They're going to hear Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke talk about what the Fed can and might do to help the economy. And there are differing views about whether the Fed should do something.
A couple weeks back, I spoke with one of the Fed's so-called doves, who told us there should be more monetary stimulus. Today, we're joined by one of the Fed's hawks, Jeffrey Lacker, who heads the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, how would you describe the U.S. economy right now?
The economy is expanding, but it's been expanding at a disappointingly slow pace. It's something that's been a matter of frustration for a lot of us. There's several reasons for this. I think we built too many homes before the recession. So we're lacking the usual rebound in home construction we usually see. Consumers have been quite cautious of late. Uncertainty about how the fiscal situation is going to be resolved in Washington, I think, is making it hard to plan, hard to figure out the rate of return on potential projects. And I think that's keeping a lot of people on the sideline. And finally, there seems to be a problem in the labor market. It doesn't seem to be as effective as it usually is at matching unemployed workers with vacant jobs.
Well, a lot of your colleagues look at that situation and they say it's time for the Fed to do more monetary stimulus. So do you agree with that?
I don't think we can increase growth much now without increasing inflation through monetary policy. And even then, I think the effect on growth is likely to be small and temporary. Inflation's under control right now. It's right where we want it, around 2%. Our job is to keep it that way. We would not be successful if we were to wait till it got a little bit out of control and then brought it back under control, because it would require a lot of hardship for American families for us to get inflation back down after it had risen too far.
But isn't it also your job to keep unemployment down, right? I mean, you want to keep full employment, and that obviously is out of control right now.
The Fed can't control unemployment. Unemployment is high now relative to its long-run averages, but the economy's been hit by some really tremendously powerful shocks over the last couple of years, and that's what's keeping unemployment high. It's just been difficult to bring down. We need to be patient. It's a long, costly process.
As you and your colleagues at the Fed go through the decision-making process that you have to go through and have had to go through the last few years, does it feel like a situation that we've been in before? Can you look back to precedent, or does it feel like every day is just – it's a brand new thing and you're not exactly sure how your decisions are going to play out in the economy?
So the fact that we've got interest rates at zero is novel. We haven't had them here since the 30s. And so that makes it a bit difficult. In addition, just what the real economy is going through is different. We have new technologies, new industries that didn't exist decades ago. So, it's always a bit of the same old business cycle, but a bit new too, a bit novel as well.
And do you see the light at the end of the tunnel as a moment when America is again really just a shining economy for the rest of the world?
I think that's coming. It may take many years. It may be just a year or two away. And I certainly hope it's sooner rather than later. But I remain confident that the long-term prospects for our economy are good. The fundamentals are there. The innovation, the flexibility and resilience of our markets, the educated workforce we have. Tricky is unleashing all that potential.
Jeffrey Lacker, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Congress and the media, including Marketplace, have heaped plenty of skepticism on for-profit colleges for their recruiting practices and low graduation rates. But some new research shows going to a for-profit college, as with the nonprofit variety, can pay off in the job market. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, here's Amy Scott.
A new paper from the National Bureau of Economic Research says an associate's degree from a for-profit college can add roughly 22% more to a person's paycheck. Co-author Stephanie Rieg-Cellini at George Washington University says graduates of community colleges see a similar increase in pay, but for-profit colleges typically cost a lot more.
This is purely an earnings bump. Does it cover what you paid for it? That's not clear.
Cellini found that students who dropped out of for-profit schools fared worse than those who didn't finish community college. Jeff Stroll is with Georgetown University's Center on Education and the Workforce.
You could imagine that when they drop out without a degree, they are close to a low-earning high school graduate.
He says for-profit colleges tend to recruit disadvantaged students who may be less prepared. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Well, when you think of the nation's worst drivers, Jeff, where do you think of first? What city comes to mind?
I would think maybe Boston or New York.
Well, you're close. The worst drivers apparently are in Washington, D.C., according to Allstate Insurance, which looks at claims data to come up with its annual list. Philadelphia, not far behind, where drivers are 64% more likely to get into an accident than the national average.
Northeast, sure.
And at the other end of the spectrum, we find Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where apparently drivers go almost 14 years on average between collisions.
I would like also to see some data on where there is actually traffic. Probably not that many options here.
Right, exactly.
Shh.
show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
In the Midwest, farmers hit by the summer's drought are hoping Hurricane Isaac will bring some rain and perhaps salvage some of the soybean and wheat crops, even if it's too late for corn in most places. We've told you a lot about the effects of the drought on U.S. farms. On to that, add now the latest farm income forecast from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The USDA says that despite, or maybe because of, the drought, U.S. farmers will set a new record this year for profits. To see what's going on here, we've got Gordon Groover. He's an associate professor of agricultural and applied economics at Virginia Tech. Hello.
Good morning.
So we have a situation where half of the U.S. corn crop is rated poor, almost that bad for soybeans. So prices are going to go up. I guess it makes sense that you would have some farmers who would be able to benefit from that, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Parts of our state in the Mid-Atlantic region, even though we're small from the standpoint of total corn crop or soybean crop, will benefit greatly from it. Those individuals also that can put water on crops during the year will benefit greatly. But those that are, you know, dry land corn and soybeans will be adversely impacted.
For farmers who are hard hit by the drought, federal subsidies can come into play. What's the effect there on farmer income overall?
One of the major issues is on crop insurance payments, and those will help cover a lot of the input cost. There are also disaster assistance payments that they can apply for relative to the region of the country they're in. So there's been a significant number of disaster declarations across the country. So,
is this as weird to you as it seems to an average person, though, the fact that in supposedly one of the worst farming years, farmers are making record profits?
In the aggregate level, that's true. But when you're a dairy farmer and or a beef cattle producer, where the impact is going to be in 6 months down the road.
Because they're buying all of this very expensive
corn. Yeah,
they're
buying the grain that is very expensive. The other point, too, is if your yields are off, even though you may be getting a high price, crop insurance payments, that's probably not going to cover the total cost of producing that year. If you look at individuals trying to make decisions that are in those drought areas, they're running counter to the trend, relatively speaking. So,
Professor Gordon Groover, agricultural and applied economist at Virginia Tech, thank you.
You're welcome.
These days, when you leave the office, if you have to work at one at all, it's easy to take the office with you on mobile devices. Maybe too easy. A survey by the software company Good Technology says more than 80% of us keep checking emails and taking calls after we leave. On average, we put in an extra 7 hours a week. Here's reporter Jacqueline Guzman.
Let's face it. We're more hooked to our mobile devices than we ever were to landlines. In New York, it's easy to find people tethered to their offices.
Most days, I'm probably checking my email, I don't know, 5 or 6 times a night. Vacations, I probably check even more, like right now.
I wake up in the middle of the night and check it, because if I don't, I'll have more work the next day. So that's why I'm so tired right now.
You just do it because people don't really understand if you, you know, especially in the U.S., why you have to take a vacation.
So we check in. On vacation, at the dinner table, and in bed. John Harima is Senior Vice President at Good Technology. He says we do it mostly to keep clients happy and to stay on top of things. But part of us likes getting messages.
You get a little burst of endorphins. But yeah, I mean, I think overall that certainly is, that idea that you're wanted and that somebody wants to connect to you. There's certainly some gratification that comes with that.
Harima says being connected does have its rewards. You can leave the office early, take long lunches with friends, and go to your child's soccer game. But all that checking in can also add up. Good Technology did a survey of this. It turns out in a year, we put in an extra month and a half of unpaid work just by checking our mobile devices after hours. Deborah DiNincenzo consults on work-life balance in the digital age. She says the boundaries of a normal workday have been blurred. Now we're not sure when it's okay to disconnect.
As a matter of fact, turning their phones off is a pretty novel idea to a lot of people.
And in a competitive job market, we're scared of being disconnected. We let work creep into our personal lives because no one tells us to stop. DiNincenzo says it's up to us to draw the line.
If you're waiting for your organization to provide work-life balance for you, you will be dead before that happens.
Unless you're paid a 24/7 salary, it's probably time to prioritize what gets answered now and what can wait for later. In New York, I'm Jacqueline Guzman for Marketplace.
And finally, Jeremy, just a little bit of space news. I found this really curious. If we need any more confirmation that NASA is thinking smaller since the end of the space shuttle program, yeah. I think this is it. You can't get much smaller than this. The agency's launched a new program to launch cell phones into space and use them as satellites. That sounds made up almost, doesn't it?
But... yeah, you send my iPhone up there into space and use its GPS device or what?
Right. Well, this one is not actually a victory for Apple. This is Android-based, for now anyway. It's called the PhoneSat program. Apparently, it's real. What an appropriate name. Basically, if you have an Android-based smartphone and you have a rocket to put it up there, NASA can send you a kit that'll help you make this happen. It has an antenna and a radiation-proof cube that is about the size of a coffee cup. That's how big this satellite is. And the idea is that all these little satellites will take pictures and record data while they're up there.
Although I guess they'll have to worry about space debris, really, to a large extent, if they're throwing everybody's cell phones into space.
And people texting them constantly so they can't right, get exactly. any of their work done. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.